Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hi guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I talk with Adam Butler, CIO of Resolve Asset Management, about his personal investment strategy and how he manages his portfolio. Adam's personal investments very much follow how Resolve builds investment strategies for clients, which tend to be globally diversified and systematic portfolios that are non-correlated to more traditional assets like stocks and bonds. After we work through the portfolio discussion, Adam offers up some thoughtful perspective on AI and kids and leaving a lasting legacy. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Resolve's Adam Butler. Good morning, Adam. How are you?
Fantastic. Really appreciate you guys having me back on. Love this show. And you guys always curate really thoughtful questions. So looking forward to it as always.
Thank you very much. We're going to have a Show Us Your Portfolio episode today where we get the pleasure and privilege to talk to you about how you think about managing your own personal investments and the investment strategy that sits at the heart of how you manage those investments. But before we sort of get into that, I just want to give a shout out and plug to your YouTube channel, Resolve Asset Management. But if you just put in the search Resolve Riffs, you'll find all the great content and material that you, Rodrigo, and Mike are putting out and all the great interviews you guys are doing on tons of different thoughtful, interesting, and deep stuff when it comes to investing in the market. So anyone watching this, you know, please go and support these guys. They're putting out great content and you know, they'll appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin. You know, it's been a labor of love, not just for me, but for Mike and Rodrigo. And you'll have noticed, no doubt, that Richard on the team really leans in as well and contributes a huge amount and really helped a lot of the background research that goes into the conversations. And I know, like you guys, we've learned a lot as we've gone along and made some mistakes. We're really fortunate to have a lot of guests that add tremendous value. And it's been, on balance, pretty fun.
Jack will never forgive me for the Friday night Resolve Riffs that we were supposed to both go on. And I had to bail. And Jack, I think it probably was his most nervous ever going on a podcast.
I remember debriefing with Jack after that and him expressing that and me being really surprised because I didn't notice that he was nervous at all. Seemed calm, cool, collected, articulate. But the show went up great. So we're happy to have him. And Justin, we got to do it again and make sure you can attend this time.
Yeah, we should. You know, if you scroll through all the guests still at Resolve Riffs, you basically see a bunch of PhDs, people who work at the Fed, and then me. So it's like one thing doesn't fit in here, but it's okay.
It's some clipboards that are worse than that. You know what I found? I don't know if you guys find the same, but you know, we can have somebody on that I consider to be just an unbelievable celebrity. And you know, no one shows up for questions because you know we run the show live, right? Maybe somebody kept someone on who's got 200,000 Twitter followers. I think it's going to be this wild conversation. Then we get someone on who has, you know, 1,000 Twitter followers who I've never even really heard of. He came in through some sort of side channel and we've got this incredibly active conversation and thousands of downloads. So, you know, I don't have any intuition about which shows are going to be more popular than others. The conversations that I think are the most engaging and novel end up getting the fewest downloads and vice versa. Like it's just a really interesting experiment.
Yeah, on that point, from what I've seen on your channel and from what I've seen on ours, I think there's two guests who you can pretty much guarantee are going to be massive episodes. And that's Mike Green and Jem Krasan. Like no matter what you do with them, like that's always like in any podcast they've been on, they're always like right at the top.
Yeah. I mean, Jem is always super popular and of course is incredibly thoughtful and is and a specialist in a field that most people find to be almost like sorcery or wizardry. And he always attracts a lot of people to the conversation and downloads, but also he attracts all these crazy crypto option, you know, nattering hordes that are, that to carry on all kinds of parallel conversations in the background. It's actually a pretty strange phenomenon, but Yeah. I mean, for the most part, I have no idea which guests are going to attract a lot of attention. Sometimes you know that they're going to be big draws, but that's few and far between.
So Adam, let's sort of get into the portfolio here. We always like to start sort of at a higher level, which is when you think about your investments, your personal portfolio, what are the main objectives? What are the main goals that you're trying to achieve with your investments?
Well, primarily, in the intermediate term, I have three children and I want to make sure that I can put them through school without them having to incur any debt. And I'm hoping that they're going to go into programs that are going to be sufficiently intense that it would be challenging for them to both carry on full-time studies and also work part-time. So, you know, I'd love for them to just be able to concentrate on their studies and get through school. And eventually, you know, I want to be able to go on and retire. I don't have grand lifestyle aspirations. You know, I'd be just as happy living in a hut on the beach in Goa, as long as there's, you know, powerful servers I can access and high-speed internet. But, you know, you've got to have some things set aside and to live on. And I'd love to be able to do something for grandkids and, you know, bring my children and grandchildren along on, you know, an annual holiday, that kind of thing. So, you know, I don't think my aspirations from a financial standpoint really diverge very much from what the average well-educated, reasonably high income professional might aspire to.
I can just picture you in your hut with all your servers. You know, people are watching don't know, but behind the scenes, we had to restart here because you have so many things running in the background, so many programming things, and like your resources are all taken up. So I can just see you in your hut, like with all this stuff running simultaneously.
Yeah, I don't know. I still to this day find the greatest flow state while programming. So, you know, if I had nothing but free time and could live off my assets, I would probably spend most of my time either programming or learning and writing about economic policy and happiness policy and that kind of stuff. So, you know, when I retire, at the moment, I don't see myself spending all my time on the golf course. You know, I probably would want to keep my mind busy and devote my energies and capacities to furthering broader humanitarian objectives.
You sort of answered my next question, which is about retirement. And I think you kind of, you know, the importance of your being with your family, being able to be with your children and grandchildren is important to you. But do you envision yourself continuing to always be working in some way, shape, or form? Or, you know, is it a little bit more, I don't know, something different?
Yeah, I'd like to think that I will continue to contribute. I mean, the benefit of retirement, to my mind, is not turning your brain off so much as having the flexibility to be able to spend time on what you're most interested in and where you think you can add the most value to the causes or activities you're most passionate about. So, you know, but, you know, I used to spend 15 hours a day coding and testing investment strategies. And I thought that my passion for back testing would last the decades, you know, and over time I've become a lot more circumspect about the value of back testing and parameter sweeps and that kind of stuff. I don't know if you can hear the crazy dog frenzy in the background here.
Someone came to the door or something.
I think retirement for you might be a dog park or dog center.
Don't laugh. Actually, my wife and I were chatting only a couple of nights ago about whether we might want to start some kind of dog shelter or something in retirement as well. We walk dogs at the dog shelter every Sunday.
Oh, nice.
And I've got a special fondness for dogs, which is hilarious because I never had any real pets growing up. And my wife had to bully me into getting our dog, but now we're inseparable. So, you know, another thing you learn about yourself, right, as you go along. So I have very loose expectations about what I'm going to be most passionate about or what I'm going to want to do in 10 or 20 years, because I know that when I go back 20 years in the past, my expectations about what I was going to be interested in and where I wanted to be today were not very well well-founded. So yeah, loosely held.
Before we ask about your portfolio, I want to ask you about the way people traditionally build theirs, which is, you know, you typically have this approach where I get my stocks, I get my bonds, I get my glide path, I adjust my allocation over time. And that's sort of the way I save, you know, for retirement. I'm wondering if you could just talk about why you think that approach might be flawed.
Well, let me start with why I think that approach may have merit. Over time, so I started my career from a real quantitative orientation, as you both know, and, you know, building up my investment framework from Markowitz and Sharpe, and wanting to maximize my overall portfolio Sharpe ratio, and eventually began to want to optimize on other definitions of absolute risk. But as I went along, I realized that most people actually care a lot less about optimizing portfolios for, you know, absolute return relative to absolute risk, and are far more concerned with keeping up with the Joneses. Or, you know, from a portfolio standpoint, they want strong returns, but what they really want is not to be left behind relative to their peer group. And there's this real sort of Thanksgiving risk where people go to their Thanksgiving dinner with family, or, you know, cocktail party risk, same kind of dimension. People are going to cocktail parties with their friends, and their friends are describing how well their equity portfolios are doing, or, you know, their growth stocks are doing, or what have you. And they don't want to be left out. They want to be participating. And as you grow wealthier and a little bit older, and you get access to deals, you know, in the wealthier categories, everyone wants to be in on the same deals, and everyone wants the same access to private equity secondaries, et cetera, right? So I think for most people that tracking error risk is far more emotionally salient, and large tracking error is far more emotionally painful even than large losses, assuming that those large losses are also being experienced by their peer group, right? The greatest fear is not meeting your financial objectives from an absolute standpoint. In other words, not having as much wealth in the future as you had initially hoped. But I think it's not having enough wealth relative to your friends in order to keep up with the same lifestyle that your friends are able to embrace, right? So, you know, over time, that shifts your understanding about how to build optimal portfolios. And to the extent that most people, especially over the last 20 or 30 years, for reasons that have to do with the performance of these relatively simple portfolios, like the endowment kind of 60-40 portfolios or glide path portfolios, they've just done really well because we've been in an economic environment that has favored those asset classes individually, and all has also favored the combination of those asset classes because they have acted as good diversifiers for one another. People have gravitated toward that. And then also from a regulatory standpoint, you know, we've migrated away from defined benefit plans for pensioners towards defined contribution plans. And many of the regulations that have been introduced over the past 20 years make it more challenging for plan sponsors to offer as defaults portfolios that deviate from that passive 60-40 orientation or passive equity bond glide path type structure, right? So for a variety of reasons, the default portfolio, which most people own, which means that most people's friends own, ends up being something like this 60-40 or GlidePath portfolio. And therefore, deviating from this portfolio carries more risk for investors from a tracking error slash lifestyle standpoint. And advisors need to pay attention to that. Does it mean that investors are probably sacrificing future absolute wealth potential? I feel confident that that's the case. From a multiple dimension of risk standpoint, is that a trade-off that most people are willing to make? Probably.
Yeah, it sort of gets to this idea that like the best portfolio for anybody is the one they can stick with. And, you know, getting back to what you just said, like we probably talked about this when we had you on last time, but this idea Jim O'Shaughnessy has about the two points of failure, you know, investors have. The first point is when they lose money, they'll panic. The second is when they underperform their friends, they'll panic. And the second one is way worse. You know, people, it's weird, but, you know, if the S&P is down 30 and I'm down 30, you know, people can usually live with that. You know, if the S&P is up 10 and you're up zero or something, like that's a big problem. So yeah, and I think what's interesting is what you guys have done with return stacking, because you're kind of splitting the difference there. You know, you're letting people get some of that, you know, 60-40 type stuff, but you're also trying to find a way to like overlay this stuff. So I think that's kind of an interesting way to deal with it and kind of go down the middle and recognize like, we could do this extreme thing, but people aren't going to stick with this extreme thing. So let's try to find something in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the more interesting writers that I've spent a lot of time investigating and internalizing is Eric Falkenstein. And he's written several papers. One of the most interesting papers, and I forget the name of it, but it effectively turns the idea of risk on its head. So if you shift the idea of risk from a preference to minimize absolute portfolio volatility to a preference to minimize tracking error, you also turn all of modern portfolio theory and the entire canon of empirical finance from, you know, Trainer and Sharpe to Fama and French, all, you know, Asness, et cetera, all the way up on its head. And I'm persuaded, having done an enormous amount of both empirical research and just sort of thinking on this subject for the last 20 years, that the vast majority of what we call anomalies in the finance literature is really just a mischaracterization of risk. And if you just pivot your perception of risk to understand that most people are actually trying to minimize tracking error rather than volatility, then a lot of these anomalies just become risk premia, but where risk is measured along this tracking error dimension rather than volatility. But what that also means is that a lot of the anomalies that the academic literature would argue are going to be arbitraged away are unlikely to be arbitraged away because the human condition is unlikely to change. In other words, most people are unlikely to want to take on more tracking error risk in order to harvest some of these opportunities that exist expressly because people are unwilling to take on more tracking error risk, right? And I mean, you see this all the time. Like for example, the CTA space is arguably the greatest diversifier for most traditional portfolios. It's the sleeve that most investors would be best off adding to their portfolio from both a correlation perspective and a economic scenario perspective. In other words, you know, managed futures CTAs historically and mechanically are expected to do best during periods of inflation shocks, for example, when both stocks and bonds for mechanical reasons are expected to do poorly. And they also have this convex payoff profile where they tend to do best, have their, you know, managed futures tends to have their best returns during quarters when stocks and bonds both do their worst, right? Have their worst returns. So from that perspective, on a conditional basis, managed futures CTAs are most complementary, but they also introduce large tracking error risk. And that's where this return stacking concept really comes into play, because the idea of return stacking is that investors don't want to sell down some portion of their stocks and or bonds in order to make room. How can we allow them to maintain 100% or very close to 100% exposure in their core portfolio allocations to minimize their potential long-term tracking error relative to their peer group, while also allowing them to layer on diversifiers like managed futures, for example, to help, you know, buttress those core portfolio allocations during periods when those, you know, both stocks and bonds are mechanically expected to do poorly. And the idea is that because you've got this, you know, 100% cash funded allocation to stocks and bonds as your core portfolio, you can use that cash funded portfolio to collateralize other exposures. And futures just make it, they're perhaps the easiest and cheapest way to take advantage of this cash funded portfolio to layer on an exposure to an active strategy on top that has the potential to be perhaps the most complementary to most people's core portfolio holdings.
Yeah, I'm hoping with what you guys are doing, with what other people are doing, you know, with managed futures being more accessible to people, I'm hoping more people will embrace it now, because, you know, managed futures have two things that are really great for investors. One is they're positive most years, and two is they're there when you need them the most. You know, when things are falling apart with stocks and bonds, you know, they're there. So if you just thought about it, if you didn't care about what the 60-40 portfolio is doing, if you just thought about it at a high level, you know, from a portfolio construction standpoint, it makes a ton of sense to have them. So I'm hoping as more products become available, more people will use these types of things, because they make absolute sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're doing our best to try to meet demand for this. We are launching, or we've already started with one ETF, and we're launching a suite of ETFs to provide exposures to both, you know, the underlying core equity sleeve, and then building different diversifiers on top, right? We're starting with managed futures because they are both the least expensive way to layer on exposure on top of a cash-funded portfolio, and they're also arguably the most complementary diversifier. But, you know, there's a lot of other so-called anomalies or risk premia, et cetera, that are nice diversifiers for traditional stocks and bonds that we are in the process of rolling out over the next few years.
One more question before we ask about your portfolio, but I wanted to ask you about data in general. You mentioned you do a lot less backtesting than you used to. And, you know, one of the things you said in our original interview is, like, one of the things that struck me the most of, like, any interview we've done on the podcast was this idea that the past is just one sample draw and an infinite series of potential sample draws. And so when I think about it, and I'm testing my strategies over 40, 50, 100 years, I have to also think, well, those 40, 50, 100 years could have played out very differently. So I'm wondering, how, when you build your portfolio, how do you think about the idea of, you know, relying on this data we have versus using, like, intuition and thinking about, like, what makes sense behind the scenes?
In terms of the fact that the history could have played out much differently, for other reasons, I was reviewing the most recent Credit Suisse annual yearbook, which is just an unbelievable resource. Elroy Dimson and his team, they put out what is often a 100-page booklet once a year that updates very long-term returns to all of the major global equity markets and global bond markets, and describes long-term average risk premia for each of the individual markets and global cap-weighted markets. And I was reflecting on the fact that the long-term equity risk premium above the rate of inflation for global equities is about 5% annualized. But there's a standard error. Now, we have a, you know, for these world markets, they go back to 1900. So we're talking about 123 years of, well, call it 122 years of data as of the last published booklet earlier this year. The standard error on that 5% compound return is 1.6%. So most people look at that 5%, they plug it in and they say, this is my expected return for global equities. For US equities, it's 6.4%. So, you know, you've got a real survivorship bias there. They happen to be either the second or third most successful global equity premium over the long term. So, you know, a lot of people just use 6.4% as their expected return for equities. I think at the very least, global equities is the right proxy for expectation setting. But with a 1.6% annual standard error, that means that the 95% confidence interval for the population mean for equity returns is somewhere between 1.8% and 8.2%, right? 1.8% or 8.2%. Now you could drive a 747 through that range for planning purposes, right? And that's 123 years of data. So there's a wide variety of ways that the past could have played out and that the future almost certainly will play out that will see returns wildly above or wildly below that long-term average. And the more you deviate from a globally diversified equity portfolio, the larger that standard error is going to be and the larger the range of potential outcomes is going to be, right? The other thing to realize is that for both a global equity portfolio and a U.S. equity portfolio, the long-term Sharpe ratio is somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.3. And the long-term Sharpe ratio of a 60-40 portfolio is somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.4, 0.45. And that's gross of taxes and fees. So net of taxes and fees, you know, you're going to be probably substantially lower. So that kind of risk-adjusted expectation provides a really wide range of potential outcomes over a typical lifespan. And so the question I always ask myself is, how do you acknowledge the wide range of the potential actual population distribution of historical returns, what that implies for forward returns for a person's typical lifespan, keeping in mind that well over half of the variance in outcomes for a person's financial situation happens within 5 years before retirement and five years after retirement. So within a 10-year span of a person's life, well over half of the variance in their financial outcomes is explained by what happens in that 10-year period. How can you make your portfolio more resilient to this uncertain future? And, you know, I keep coming back to the idea that you want to have as many different sources of return that are derived from as many different sources of risk, or, you know, and where risk is defined not just in terms of volatility, like we typically think of for equities and bonds, but also in terms of tracking error. So for, you know, things like trend or global carry or global value or betting against beta or, you know, volatility premium, that sort of thing. All of these different sources of return that are complementary to those traditional equity and bond returns. And I also wonder if by virtue of the regulatory imperative to invest in equities and bonds, and the psychological anchoring to equities and bonds from a tracking error perspective, whether the prospective forward returns on a risk-adjusted basis for stocks and bonds is lower today than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago, notwithstanding where we are in terms of valuations, but just in terms of other factors like default allocations, risk aversion to tracking error, and all of these other dimensions, you know, probably we just don't need as high a required return on equities and bonds to attract this level of investment in those asset classes. And therefore, prospective returns for equities and bonds is going to be lower going forward on an expectation basis. And therefore, the addition of as many of these potential alternative risk premia or diversifiers is that much more urgent. So, you know, that's kind of where I land on this spectrum. I want to diversify as much as possible because I have a very acute sense of the level of uncertainty in the system.
Adam, I do think you should copyright the one sample draw in an infinite series of potential sample draws, because Jack basically uses that at least once a week. So
if I do. I'm always trying to remind myself of that because I think it's so important to keep that in mind as you're testing things and as you're looking at things. I think that's like I should write it on my computer and just keep it there all the time.
Copyright it and then start charging excess returns of royalty.
That's right.
Exactly. You can charge me. I'll pay you every time I use it.
Well, it is shocking, though, how few people internalize that based on the conversations that I see play out, for example, over Twitter or the conversations that we have regularly with clients or with advisors. People seem very anchored to historical distributions as though there's some physical law of the universe that makes those historical distributions likely to manifest in the same way in the future. And without even accounting for the standard error that we know exists, even in the historical draws. So I think that continuing to remind yourself that what we have experienced through history is just one draw in an infinite multiverse of ways that history could have played out keeps you humble in terms of what you expect from your investments and for other dimensions of your life going forward in the future. And that humility, hopefully at the margin, urges people to think more broadly about diversification and making their portfolio resilient to a wider variety of potential future paths.
So how do you think about taking all those principles you just talked about and turning them into your personal portfolio? How do you think about constructing your portfolio?
Yeah, for asset managers, it's perhaps a more interesting puzzle than for other investors because, you know, we are by definition invested to a beta of much higher than one in whatever strategies that we employ in our products, right? Now, my product suite at Resolve has a beta to equities and bonds of pretty close to zero. So I'm not particularly worried about what happens to equities and bonds. If anything, my concern is that the equity and bond premium turns out to be much larger than expected going forward, because as a function of our net beta of zero, we are effectively short those betas. So, you know, in theory, I should be jamming my portfolio, my personal portfolio, full of traditional betas, right? I don't, because, you know, I can't help but still have too much hubris in my own views about prospective returns for these traditional asset classes, stocks and bonds, given current valuations. And I also think, just know too much of history. I know that these asset classes, that stocks historically have a long-term Sharpe ratio of around 0.3, that bonds historically have a Sharpe ratio of about 0.2. and that those are relatively unattractive compared to other potential strategies that I can employ. Everybody wants to own stocks and bonds because they want to minimize tracking error. And also people want to minimize complexity in their portfolios. They want to minimize exposures to things that they don't understand. There's an aversion to complexity. There's an aversion to fees. Many people have been brainwashed about efficient markets and therefore kind of avoid active strategies altogether. I am sympathetic to the view that equity, that stock picking type active strategies are likely to have lower expected performance than macro oriented strategies. And the reason I say that is because I subscribe to Samuelson's dictum, Paul Samuelson, the famous economist, who said in a letter to Bob Shiller, who also won the Nobel Prize, that in his whatever 40 or 50 years of experience, both investing and observing markets and economics, that markets are probably micro efficient and macro inefficient. And I think the reason why he said that is because of the way that institutionally, the way that investment firms are organized. So there's typically an equity team and there's a fixed income team. And that's true at pensions, true at endowments. It's true at broker dealers and investment, you know, large investment advisors that have investment teams, right? You've got equity strategists and an equity team. You've got bond strategists and a bond team. And maybe you've got a small asset allocation team that is responsible for setting some kind of long-term policy portfolio at an institution or a strategic asset allocation for private clients. And those strategic asset allocations all look pretty close to one another. You know, they all look for a growth investor, something like 70% equities, 30% bonds. Maybe for a moderate risk investor, 60-40, for a conservative investor, 40-60 or 30-70, right? But they all kind of look the same, and those policy allocations don't change very much through time, right? So I'm going to say something like 99.9% of all cognitive and computational resources that are focused on active research in securities is focused on trying to pick the best stocks and avoid the worst stocks within their equity silo, and the same in the bond silo, and some vanishingly small residual of research expertise and energy is focused on, you know, dynamically allocating between different equity markets, different bond markets, different segments of the fixed income market. Commodities, currencies, rates, and all of the other more exotic instruments that are available in the macro space, like volatility swaps and inflation swaps and all of that kind of stuff, right? So just by virtue of that relative allocation of research resources and mandate flexibility, the ability for a large institution to dramatically shift the relative allocation between equities and bonds and commodities, et cetera, over tactical time horizons, or the compliance regulated ability for advisors to shift allocations for their clients in any sort of tactical way is so limited. For all of these different reasons, my personal opinion is that there are much larger and more sustainable anomalies or risk premia at the macro level, trading asset classes, for example, across futures markets, than are likely to exist to arbitrage within equities or within bonds, for example. So, you know, for those reasons, I tend to allocate, even though my personal business beta is so heavily levered to these alternative macro premia, I still think that they hold the greatest long-term prospects for delivering high long-term Sharpe ratios and therefore all of my invested money is invested in those kinds of strategies and candidly, my own strategies in that domain. And the other part of my portfolio is invested in cash, and the cash is just a hedge against the tracking error and the concentrated risk of my business investment that I have personally in my own asset management business.
So like the Resolve stuff, would you say your personal portfolio also has a beta to stocks and bonds of close to zero?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other challenge that investors have, and this is true even for very experienced investors. So I think I've got reasonably deep expertise in quantitative strategies. If I go out and try to do due diligence on another manager that runs quantitative strategies, just by virtue of that manager wanting to protect whatever they perceive their novel edge to be in markets, they're not going to be able to tell me everything, or they're not going to be willing to tell me everything about what went into the thinking and the experimental design and the portfolio construction and the day-to-day practical execution elements of their investment strategy. And therefore, I'm operating at a once removed, at the very least, disadvantage relative to that underlying manager in being able to determine the relative merits of that manager's strategies. At the very least, when I allocate to my own strategies, I have the deepest possible understanding about all of the decisions I've made, the trade-offs that I've made, and the uncertainties that are embedded in my experimental design and all of the methods that I've taken to try to minimize those uncertainties and ambiguities, and the residual uncertainties and ambiguities that are impossible to either diversify away or remove through more data or better experimental techniques. So I just feel more comfortable allocating to my own strategies because I know them the best, and I'm acutely aware of all of the things that I can't know about other people's strategies. And from the perspective of stocks and bonds, I just think that they're over-owned and they have pretty low prospective expected risk-adjusted returns relative to the other premia that I choose to invest in.
And so you're primarily accessing the asset classes via either futures or products that own futures, right?
That's right, yes.
And you're taking a long-short approach.
Correct, yeah. I mean, it's okay. Our products, our publicly facing products are all effectively return stacking products, right? So our mutual fund that we launched many years ago has a global risk parity passive core, and then we stack a global systematic multi-strat on top, right? So there is an allocation to global diversified betas, global equities, global bonds, global commodities, in a risk-diversified way, but that represents about one-third of my risk, and the other two-thirds of my risk budget is the diversified systematic global macro overlay. And because I've got stocks, bonds, and commodities in the portfolio in such a risk-balanced way, combined with the risk overlay, or sorry, the alpha overlay, my beta ends up being pretty close to zero.
How do you think about leverage? We asked Corey this question when he was on. You know, when you have all these uncorrelated return streams, I think when you test it historically, you could say, I can lever this up a lot, and still be okay. But Corey was talking about how you have to be careful about that. You know, you obviously going back to the idea of one sample draw and an infinite series of the sample draws, like, how do you think about like how much leverage to apply, like an optimal amount of leverage to apply to a portfolio?
So the idea of leverage is to empower an investor to be able to eat their high Sharpe ratio, right? The idea you want a diversified portfolio because the more uncorrelated return streams you add to it, the more return you get per unit of volatility. But if you just continue to add return streams to a portfolio, like uncorrelated return streams to a portfolio, eventually you get a portfolio with a very moderate expected return, but very low risk. So the idea is there, if I can tolerate, so I have a portfolio that with no leverage, I'm expected to get about 3% excess returns for, you know, 2% annualized volatility. And I'm able to take, to tolerate a volatility that is approximately the same as what a normal balanced portfolio might provide. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12% a year. Well, I can take that portfolio and lever it up, call it 5 times. And now my expected return is somewhere in the neighborhood of 15% a year, with obviously a wide cone of uncertainty, as we've already discussed, with a 10% volatility. So now I can eat that really high Sharpe ratio, or eat that really high expected return per unit of risk that is offered by this extremely diversified portfolio. So, you know, do I want to lever it up 5 times? Well, I mean, I guess it depends. I mean, if I'm holding a basket of Eurodollar futures or T-bill futures, then, you know, if I lever up a T-bill 5 times, you know, how much risk am I taking? Certainly there's jump risk and there are shocks. I mean, we just had a very substantial rate shock in March.
There's like 10 standard deviations or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, which really just means that the distribution has major jump risk, right? And we experienced that in March. And that was very painful for many CTAs that traded rates, right? We had a painful March in several of our mandates for that reason. And, you know, you kind of have to live with that. But, I mean, would I want to lever up a commodity portfolio 5 times? Well, no, obviously not, right? But if I have an extraordinarily diversified portfolio, not just in terms of the different uncorrelated strategies that I'm allocating to, but also in terms of a wide array of very different kinds of assets, including currencies and rates and government bonds of different maturities, in addition to equities and commodities, well, if my current set of active strategies are implying a very high expectancy over the next period of several days to several weeks, then, yeah, I mean, I probably should be okay with taking on even material amounts of leverage to take advantage of the very high implied risk-adjusted returns. Does that mean I should leave it completely unconstrained? Probably not. You know, we impose constraints on our strategies to avoid too high levels of concentration in any one sector, for example, because of known jump risks and because we know that volatility and risk can't be perfectly modeled. And obviously, we want to avoid major catastrophic outcomes. But prudent leverage while enforcing a minimization of concentration risk in any one market or sector and imposing maximum levels of leverage to avoid the challenge with being able to take on a very large amount of leverage in order to take advantage of a large amount or many different uncorrelated strategies across many different markets is that you do have periods where many managers observing the same edges as you're observing are all concentrated in very, very large bets, even if those bets are relatively diversified in asset space. If they are relatively concentrated in manager space, you could have a cascading risk. Small shawl of the managers are allocated to with very high leverage can cause a cascade that requires all managers to de-lever at the same time. And if all managers are selling the same things at the same time, it's kind of like shouting fire in a crowded theater. And it can create more of a painful loss to all of those managers. And so the ability to both A, observe the total amount of expected leverage across managers of a similar type, and therefore be aware of that. And when all these managers have these large bets on, you're scaling back your leverage in response because you understand that the conditional risk at that time is much higher than normal. And also setting overall portfolio constraints on a maximum amount of leverage that you can take on. All of these steps and acknowledgement of these risks make eminent sense, and we apply them in our mandates. But being afraid of leverage for leverage's sake means that you're no longer able to take advantage of diversification's free lunch. And I think that's a mistake.
Just one more for me before I hand it back to Justin. Other than your ownership at Resolve, do you do anything else on the private side? Angel investing, private equity, anything like that?
Well, I don't think that I have any edge in angel investing or venture. And I don't believe that private equity produces any kind of edge either. I mean, all of the research demonstrates pretty conclusively that if you simply own a portfolio sorted on something like enterprise value to EBITDA and profitability, then, and you lever that up somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.6 times, then you can deliver higher risk-adjusted returns than what we've observed in private equity over the long term. And now, given how crowded private equity is and the valuations that had been priced into private equity over, you know, over deal flow over the last 5 or 10 years, I have strong conviction that the forward returns to private equity and private credit as well are going to be much lower than we've seen in the past. I don't think there's any premium there, so I have no interest in investing in private equity. I do think there's something in venture, but the secret to venture is extreme diversification, in my opinion. I mean, typically with venture, you've got a portfolio of, you're holding a portfolio of far out of the money options. The vast majority of those options, somewhere in the neighborhood of 95 to 99 out of 100 are going to expire worthless. And one of them is going to go on to compound 1,000-fold, and it will make up for the losses that you experience in all of the others. But if you don't have the ability to personally invest in several hundred different companies and have the resources to do due diligence and research into putting together that basket of companies and making sure that they're maximally diversified across a wide variety of different kinds of bets, then I think you're absorbing all of the risk with a very minimal chance of getting a payoff that will overcome all of the losses that you incur along the way. So, yeah, I mean, that's a long-winded answer of saying, I don't personally think I have an edge, and so I avoid those categories.
Do you personally do anything in crypto, or do you see an opportunity to potentially add cryptocurrencies to any of your products in the future?
I personally have a small allocation to crypto, more as a hedge against financial nihilism or financialization. And I do think that there's going to be something that comes of blockchain tech. It's probably not going to come from the currency side. I think it's probably going to come from a solution to the problem of authenticity, deepfakes. So having some kind of indelible record of a human that has done something, because we're very soon going to be flooded with AI-generated content, and it's going to be very difficult to distinguish for a human between what has been generated by machines and what has authentically been generated by humans. And we're going to need some sort of ledger or technology to track that. But I mean, I don't think there's any fundamental merit to cryptocurrencies. It's, you know, it's a little bit of a hedge against tracking error risk for me. Just sort of the risk of continued exponential financialization of the economy.
You've been studying AI and machine learning for a long time and thinking about it. And I think that the ChatGPT stuff obviously has brought this all to the forefront. We had Gene Munster and his colleague, Doug Clinton from Deepwater Asset Management. And they're kind of, you know, pretty respected tech analysts. And they have their secular themes that they're thinking about and studying. And one of the things is obviously AI. And they're, you know, we had them on the podcast and they were saying that they think AI is going to be as big as the internet. And we've heard that kind of being floated around. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that. And then as a follow-up, you know, are you trying, it doesn't sound like your portfolio is like you've done anything to try to position to take advantage of that. I mean, if you don't believe that, then, you know, you wouldn't want to make any moves in your portfolio probably to try to benefit from maybe the wealth that might be generated there. But I'm just curious, like, would you think about that in any way in trying to get on that train and actually generate wealth through that or not?
I think this is a very tricky time. It's possible that big tech is able to capture the AI space. And there certainly is a push by many of the progenitors of this AI, of the best AI tech, like OpenAI and Microsoft, for example, to make a big deal about the risks of open sourcing this technology. And my personal view is that it is in the interest of big tech to play up the risks of allowing open source access to this revolutionary tech, so that they get to capture all the value, so that there will be a narrow group of tech companies that will be blessed by regulators with the ability to have access to this tech and innovate on this tech. And therefore all the value will accrue to these. And that's sort of the Blade Runner kind of future. I am hopeful because all of the interesting work that I'm seeing within the AI development space is coming from the open source community. And the open source models are now getting very close to the capabilities of the private models. And that innovation curve, I think, is only going to accelerate over time. So I'm hopeful that AI is going to be transformative and liberate humanity from a lot of the uninteresting work that humans do on a day-to-day basis. I'm not sure that it's going to revolutionize the profitability of tech firms or companies in general. I think there's an enormous amount of ambiguity about regulations that are going to be put in place on this tech. And I think it's even very difficult to look back and identify whether the internet had a major impact on total factor productivity, for example. You know, most of the studies that I've seen on the growth rate of total factor productivity, for example, the Philippa paper that came out a couple of years ago, suggests that we haven't experienced any sort of exponential curve in innovation since the 1930s. It's been a straight line. So, you know, I think it's really hard to anticipate where the value will accrue, which sectors will reap the greatest benefits from it. And at the moment, the big tech companies are being priced as though they're going to capture all of the economics, and they're being priced for a level of economic or profit generation that is near the upper ends of reasonable expectations. So, you know, I'm not sure there's a huge opportunity for investment at this point. Is there opportunity for an experienced small cap growth manager to identify firms that are doing novel things with AI tech? Probably. Is that going to be available to most investors? Probably not.
I wanted to pivot here and ask you about your kids. You mentioned you have three kids. I have two girls. Jack has a little girl and a little boy. And what I want to ask you was, when you think about your legacy a little bit, and obviously money isn't the only thing that is important to someone's legacy, but do you what is your feeling or your sense of leaving money to your children later on in life? Do you think that that is something that you think you would like to do? Do you think that that's good? Do you think that's bad? Where do you sort of fall on that?
Mostly, I just don't want to disadvantage my children. So it really depends on the policy framework that exists at the time when I'm about to leave a legacy and at the state of markets and the economy. At the moment, we've all decided to live in a world that rewards people who already have assets and effectively casts aside people who don't already start with the head start of a decent asset portfolio. A big reason for that is because most of the lending that has, you know, most of the credit that has been originated in the economy over the last 20 years is backed by assets. And so it's increasingly difficult for people to be able to, for example, get enough of a down payment to put for a home simply by saving from their traditional work product, right? And we're seeing a lot of the effects of this kind of financialization phenomenon where the value of assets is set by the availability of credit and not by people's ability to save or people's incomes. In behavior like the financial nihilism of meme stocks or the financial nihilism of crypto pyramid schemes, all to say that if this trend continues the way it's going, where the game is that you can't be successful unless your parents leave you with enough assets to get started, then I guess I will need to leave my children with enough assets to get started. If we revert to a policy framework that looks a little bit like what happened, you know, more like what was in place during the 50s and 60s with very high marginal tax rates, very high estate taxes or, you know, very low legacy values where most people end up starting at around the same level, even if, you know, those with very rich parents and those with poor parents all kind of start at the same place in terms of opportunity, then I would love to be able to leave my children less so as to unshackle them from the bonds of having to, you know, carry on from the legacy that I leave them and allow them to make something of their own lives on their own. So it really just depends.
Yeah, I think that that's an excellent way to think about it and certainly opened my eyes to you know, a very interesting way to think about it. You know, in America, it used to be the goal was to be able to buy a house. That is what your average middle family wanted. That was you've made it when you got a house, you know. People worked hard to buy that house, but ultimately that was the American dream. Now it's like, just given where home prices are, I live in Connecticut, so there's like a housing shortage. Housing prices are up, whatever they are off the bottom, and it's a big issue. I mean, you know, first time buyers basically just can't get into the market, and so, you know, if that trend doesn't correct itself, it's going to continue that way.
30 years of supply side policy, you know, we've demonstrated that the private sector will never build enough homes to satisfy demand, because providing or preserving a level of scarcity buttresses their profitability. So, you know, supply side policy is never going to lead to outcomes that benefit the majority of people. It is always going to lead to the institution of regulatory capture and other avenues to preserve scarcity in order to preserve the margins of the private sector.
When you think about your personal portfolio, what do you think the biggest mistake that you've made is, and what would you say you learned from it?
Oh, well, looking back, I mean, clearly not having any equity beta in my portfolio has been a major setback. I mean, obviously the Sharpe ratio of global equities, almost exclusively because of the unbelievable performance of U.S. equities, and really, you know, maybe a double handful of mega clap U.S. tech stocks, the Sharpe ratio of global equities has been 3 times the long-term average over the last decade or so. So anyone with a perspective on history, with a equity allocation that is informed by that historical perspective, is going to be looking back with regret against not having enough equity exposure in the portfolio over the last, whether that trend is going to continue is anybody's guess. I personally have made a bet on my understanding of the historical context, and I guess I'm going to live or die by that understanding and expectation.
But I also think it's important with mistakes to kind of look at them in two contexts. One is, was it a mistake based on what I know now? And the other is, was it a mistake based on what I knew then? And, you know, that probably is not a mistake based on what you knew then. So a lot of times it's hard to kind of look at what happened and say, all right, that was a mistake. But, you know, realistically, you obviously had a thoughtful process you used to make that decision. And going back to your point about, there's a lot of different ways things can play out. And you know, sometimes they play out against the way you're positioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most people engage in resulting, which is, I'm going to blame you or hold you accountable for what happened rather than hold you accountable for the thought process that went into the decision that you made prior to knowing the outcome, right? So yeah, 10 years ago, based on a variety of factors, my expectation was that equity returns were going to be lower than average, which meant a Sharpe ratio lower than 0.3. Bonds were yielding 3.5%. A 60-40 portfolio had considerably lower than average long-term expected return potential. I invested accordingly. The future ended up playing out very differently than my expectation. If I went back, would I have done the analysis differently? Maybe I would have been more humble. I mean, the last 10 years, I like to think that people get more humble as they get older because they learn more hard lessons, right? They observe and reflect on the fact that things didn't play out exactly as expected, and that should, at the margin, promote a level of humility. If I look around, I'm not sure that's the case. But for me, definitely, I've gotten a lot more humble about, almost everything in my life. And as a result of that, I try to make a lot more bets than I even would have wanted to make 10 years ago.
Just a couple more as we wrap up, and you've been incredibly generous with your time. We really appreciate it. We like to ask this question towards the end that gets us to the idea that not everything we invest money in is in the goal of generating more money. You know, a lot of things we invest money in are with the goal of generating happiness in our lives. And so I always give the example of, I have a racing sailboat, and a racing sailboat is a horrific investment. You're throwing money at it all the time. But like, I can go out on a Wednesday night, I do a race with my friends, I have a few beers, like I get a lot of benefit in my life from that. And I'm wondering if there's anything in your life like that, that may not be the greatest financial investment, but it's something you get a lot of joy from.
Investing in your relationship with your children and the memories that you create along the way, I think is the best investment that you can make. So we prioritize travel because, well, first of all, we all love to travel and we love history and we love hiking and experiencing other cultures and the food and the other dimensions of these cultures, but also because as a family, it's a way to isolate your children from all of the other distractions of their friends and their activities and all of the other things, and your own, you know, distractions, in order to have concentrated, undistracted time together to have experiences, learn together, learn from one another, and make the kinds of memories that form the bonds that keep you together over time. So, you know, investing in travel and other kinds of adventures, you know, investing in the kids' activities. So investing time and money in a variety of different sports and other kinds of activities to help my children discover what they're good at, what they're passionate about, and build the type of confidence that only comes from the practice and development of competency in a variety of different domains, right? I think the thing I want to leave my kids with as their great, as the greatest legacy that I can give them, is a sense of self-worth and confidence that comes from overcoming and triumphing in the face of a variety of challenges, from small to large, you know, that you get from throwing them in the deep end and watching them swim, or, you know, watching them build up a skill set from many, many years of diligent practice and all of the skills that go along with that. And, you know, that's no small investment, my parents. It's a monetary investment. It's also a massive investment in time. You know, it's 4 or 5 mornings a week getting up at 5 a.m. so that your child can go to hockey practice, or in our case, swim practice. You know, my 3 kids all swim. So that's 15 to 18 hours a week at the pool. It's a lot of early mornings over, you know, almost a 20-year time span. It's a lot of travel, both by the kids and by us. And so, you know, I think all of those are investments in your children, in yourself, in your own memory, in your own happiness, and that of your spouse. And I think it's pretty well impossible to calculate the economic value of those investments.
Adam, I think that's a great way to end what was a really good discussion. So thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Have a good summer, and looking forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks, guys. It's an honor to be invited back. It's always a genuine pleasure to chat with you guys. Like I said at the beginning, you always come with very thoughtful questions and makes for a really fun conversation. So let's do it again sometime, perhaps on Riffs.
Yeah, let's do it. You're coming this time, Justin, if we do it. All right, thank you, Adam.
Exactly. Thank you.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.